Good afternoon. I can't tell you what a great honor it is to be here, and what a pleasure. I'd like to begin by telling you less about the authors of the article, since that great introduction also already told you that, yes, there we go. CIRI is a multidisciplinary group of researchers, faculty, graduate students, postgraduate students. We have people from communications, computing and information science, conflict resolution, psychology, as well as law. Since 2009, we've been partnering with federal agencies to design smart participation systems for rulemaking and other policymaking processes. And smart participation uses Web 2.0 and other emerging technologies to bring new voices into the process, to provide opportunities and incentives for participants to become more informed about the issues, the competing interests and arguments, and the legal and other constraints that are involved in a policy decision. Smart systems support people, especially new participants, in making their contributions as effectively as possible, and they make decision makers more knowledgeable by getting participation that sometimes provides new information, but also, and as important, confirms what decision makers think they know, or reveals gaps in existing knowledge that need further research. You know, basically, smart participation is designing and using technology to connect what people know with what government decision makers need to know. Some of you, hopefully, are familiar with our smart participation platform designed for rulemaking, Regulation Room. We've offered 4 Department of Transportation rulemakings. Actually, you can see that on the posters. That collaboration got DOT a White House Leading e-Government Practices Award. More recently, we've been working with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau last year to do a public comment on their residential mortgage servicing rules. And most recently, in this discussion, public comment that just closed on a potential rulemaking on consumer debt collection practices. This was our first advance notice of proposed rulemaking. You know, as many of you know, methods for getting public participation in rulemaking have changed radically over the last 30 years. You know, we started out with doing everything on paper, and if you wanted to read comments, you had to go to the reading room. Then, of course, the Internet makes an enormous change, and we see the Federal Register going online. We see agencies experimenting with online dockets, and ultimately we have the development and continued evolution of regulations.gov, where, as you probably know, almost any rulemaking by almost any federal agency, the materials can be found online, and people can comment online. And then, of course, we get to Web 2.0. And all those amazing, highly interactive technologies for people to create, contribute, and share information online. We have a tendency as humans to see things like this as a natural progression. Each new method is superior to the one that comes before it, so that it should become the new normal for agencies to use in all rulemakings. A different perspective on this, and one that's just been adopted by the Administrative Conference of the United States in their recommendations to agencies on the use of social media in rulemaking, is that, you know, as long as you have a regulations.gov and sort of the conventional rulemaking commenting methods, these fulfill the agency's legal responsibility to give notice and get comment. So agencies should think of rulemaking 2.0 as supplements, that is, tools that they can use selectively to try to overcome the shortcomings that we know continue to exist in the public commenting process, even with the improvements and innovations that we see continuing to happen in, say, the online Federal Register and regulations.gov. Our article, Rulemaking versus Democracy, came out of our experience with our agency partners and our users in developing a Rulemaking 2.0 participation platform. And it was our first effort to try to identify the principles that should guide agencies in thinking about when and how to supplement with technology to get broader, better rulemaking participation. Now, in terms of these principles, we continue to see the most important of them as this one. A democratic government should not actively facilitate public participation that it does not value. Now, you might say, well, why would you need a principle like that? You know, won't agencies automatically be motivated to use technology to get participation they actually want and will use? Well, not necessarily. This advice appeared in a publication for federal agency managers, Federal Computer Week, on how agencies should use social media more effectively. Asking people, how are we doing, is less productive. Asking them, what is your favorite national park, might get more response. Agencies are under a lot of pressure from inside and outside government to use social media and open government initiatives and to demonstrate that what they're doing is working. And one of the easiest metrics for that is volume of public response. Number of hits, number of likes, number of retweets, number of comments. Our no bread and circuses principle reminds agencies that they have a responsibility not to ask for kinds of participation that at the end of the day don't really have much value in their decision making. And we think this is a responsibility not just because dealing with high volume, low value participation diverts limited agency resources, although this has been a problem for some agencies in rulemaking. The more fundamental problem, we believe, is that it can breed resentment, cynicism, and even disengagement from citizens. You know, we at SERI strongly believe that participation has an intrinsic civic value in a democracy, a value apart from whatever information it might produce for government decision makers. But people aren't stupid. Participants who perceive that the input that the government has asked them for either disappears into a black hole or gets just a formulaic response tend not to react well. And we've seen this kind of angry blowback in some open government participation initiatives in the past few years. Oops, I'm sorry. Don't want you to quite look at that yet. Excuse me. So a central goal of our research has been helping agencies figure out when and how social media and other new technologies can make rulemaking better by remediating shortcomings in the existing notice and comment process. And the most glaring of these shortcomings is inequitable participation. Even though everyone has a right, an equal right, right, to make a comment, to have the agency consider their comment in the course of its decision-making. In fact, it's the old problem of forbidding rich and poor alike from sleeping under bridges. The notice and comment process has been, and according to research, has continued to be, dominated by national and international corporations, trade and professional organizations, and other large, well-resourced entities. Individual consumers and other beneficiaries, small business owners, state, local, and tribal governments, or NGOs, that will be affected by federal policies, systematically participate less frequently, less intensively, and less effectively. And Regulation Room was designed to bring these missing voices into the process and to provide them with the kind of information and support that enables them to understand and comment meaningfully on what the agency is proposing and why. Although the platform is always open to everyone, our participants are overwhelmingly newcomers. For example, in this consumer debt collection practices discussion that just closed, 83% of users reported never having participated before in a federal rulemaking. But new participants present a challenge. This came from an actual user in a DOT rulemaking that was proposing new airline passenger rights. You remember this, tarmac, delay, public, you may remember this, baggage fees. And what he said was, I'm interested in this regulation, but I do not want to spend a lot of time reading or submitting comments. How can I just voice my opinion in an easy way? My suggestion is to state the section of the proposed regulation, then ask for votes, using, for example, five choices from strongly agree to strongly disagree, with the option of adding comments to any question. What you have already is useful, but too time-consuming for me. If new airline passenger rights legislation was being legislated by Congress, a participation platform that allows people to register the direction and intensity of their preferences and throw in a comment if they want might be very useful. In fact, some of you may be familiar with the very interesting new platform VoxPop, which is using some sophisticated ways to do exactly that. But rulemaking isn't set up to be like legislation or voting on a referendum. The agency, as you know, is legally required to, and courts are quite prepared to enforce, a process of reasoned decision-making. That process involves collecting and assessing facts, examining alternatives, identifying its policy objectives and tying them to the statute, acknowledging competing interests and values, and giving good reasons for what it chooses. If a rulemaking commenter wants to have an impact on that kind of decision-making process, simply expressing an outcome preference, I strongly agree or disagree with what you're proposing to do, isn't enough. Sophisticated industry commenters understand that very well. So if the goal is using technology to remediate participation inequities, then we shouldn't settle for this kind of easy but low-value engagement from consumers and small business owners and other rulemaking newcomers. So in our own research and design practice, we emphasize what we call the shared responsibility of smart participation. The participation designer's job? Yeah, to create the best possible environment for users of different ages, education levels, and socioeconomic circumstances to recognize, understand, and effectively use their right to participate. The citizen's job? To decide whether participation is important enough to put in the work that's required. We argue that this flows through into an agency's decision about when and how to use rulemaking 2.0 methods to supplement existing notice and comment participation. And we encourage our agency partners to concentrate their efforts to enhance participation by doing two things, picking the right rules and providing the right tools. Picking the right rules is about asking first whether it's reasonably predictable that new participation could add relevant, helpful information to the rulemaking. And then the agency needs to ask whether it can do what it takes, which is usually a matter of both technology and human effort, to elicit this information from new participants. Based on our experience in now 7 live rulemakings, a rule is a good candidate for enhanced participation efforts when 2 conditions are present. The first I've already talked about. You know, can we identify one or more groups directly affected by the rulemaking who historically have been undervoiced, or as we now call it a little more simply, missing? And I want to emphasize there's no particular political valence to these groups. They are often beneficiaries of a new rule, for example, consumers with troubled mortgages, but as often, they're individuals whose conduct will be regulated, like the small business owners who are independent owner-operators of commercial motor vehicles. And frequently, they're third parties who will be directly impacted, airline flight crews, state or local government entities that will have new enforcement duties, consumer credit counseling organizations. Second, the question is, can we identify knowledge that these groups are likely to have because they have lived on-the-ground experience with what the agency is proposing? And it's this situated knowledge that enables these new participants to make a contribution that goes beyond just urging the agency to adopt or scrap the proposed rule. That kind of contribution happens when a traveler with disabilities describes the actual problems she has navigating an airport environment and worries that a regulatory focus on more accessible check-in kiosks might mean fewer consumer service agents who can do the things that only human assistants can provide for her. That kind of participation happens when the manager of a small community bank or credit union explains how the ongoing relationships that their institution has with their home mortgage customers are very different than the way huge mortgage servicing companies treat accounts in their portfolio. It happens when a senior citizen who's being continually robocalled because she happens to have the same name as somebody who owes a lot of money goes and gets into a back and forth with someone who works for a small debt collection company about whether and how automated calling should be regulated. Bringing missing stakeholders into the process and nudging them to go beyond voting and venting, to talk about what they know from their situated experience, to engage with others who have a different experience and perspective, and to evaluate and perhaps suggest changes in what the agency is proposing. That takes work. We talk some about that in the article. We talk a lot more about it in this report. that was done by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which is free. I have some copies. You can get copies either at their site or on our website. But the point, our point has been that bringing missing voices into rulemaking is possible with the thoughtful use of smart participation technologies. And the results could be satisfying and valuable to participants and agencies alike. And we shouldn't shortchange these new voices by encouraging them to participate in ways that are really less than what they're capable of. With that, I'll stop.
Thank you, Professor. Avi, do you want to go next?
Yeah. Can y'all hear me if I do this from here? Okay. Well, first of all, let me just thank ELI and Vanderbilt, obviously, for putting on the conference and inviting me, and also to thank Professor Farina for writing the article. It was a very interesting topic and certainly quite salient for the work that we do. I also want to thank Marna McDermott, who's the agency's Associate Deputy General Counsel, and my co-author here. So to the extent that there's good ideas, either that I speak about now or that are in our comment, they're clearly the result of our collaboration. And if I say something that sounds utterly foolish, it's because I failed to consult with her beforehand. A couple things just to start out with. EPA, where obviously I work, gets millions of comments every year on a variety of rulemakings. I think if you look at the OIRA website for significant rulemakings, we are either at the top or near the top, probably year after year. And one of the reasons I think that is because the mission of the agency to protect human health and the environment literally touches every American, which is not what I think every agency can say at all times. And so if you think about that, everybody in this country is to some degree a consumer of our work, a consumer of air and water. And so you will always, with virtually everything that we do, have a large disparity between people who have a vested interest in our rulemakings and the outcomes relative to those persons who really may have some specialized scientific or technical expertise that itself has a close nexus to the statutory standard or the provision that we're doing with, that we're dealing with. So we are really at all times kind of dealing with that, the fact that folks who are affected by what we do don't always seemingly have the expertise that can be easily pigeonholed into one of the specific statutory factors. But we do get comments, of course, like every agency, in many forms. They range from the large submissions from trade associations or NGOs, you know, that come with large, with lots of attachments and the law firms on the cover. We do get lots of comments from individuals around particular facilities that we're considering regulating under a particular provision. But then we also get the kind of mass comments that I think the professor has written a little bit about in the article from NGOs or other organizations who have expressed a view, expressed opinion, and through a website or other means made it a little bit more easy for individuals to register their views about them. And then, of course, with the new technology to submit them to the EPA. My concern, I guess, and kind of the thrust of Marna and my article a little bit, was we ought not kind of prejudge where these comments come from. And my real concern is that to the extent we start rendering value judgments about how valuable they are to us, the line is going to move. I mean, one, I think the line will move literally administration to administration, which itself, I think, presents some complications in the kind of world of administrative law and rulemaking. But you are, by necessity, I think, going to be excluding some voices and some comments that, while the value may be different than some of the other more substantive or scientific-based submissions, nevertheless does have a value in and of itself. The first thing, certainly, that we start out with at EPA and all the agencies do is what the statutes require. So off the bat, we're dealing with an Administrative Procedures Act that basically allows people to submit their views. Clean Air Act separately allows, you know, people to submit their comments, and they don't really do any line drawing there. It's not, there's nothing, I think, in those statutes that says, you know, only submit comments if you can really identify the specific provision or subprovision that you think it's most closely aligned with. That, I think, would exclude a lot of folks. And so we have a requirement under the law to accept people's views and comments on things. The important thing to note, I think, is where we are today and I guess where we were a number of years ago. There clearly was a time when it was difficult logistically to assemble, to deal, to consider, you know, all the comments that probably came in. I think Marna and, and I made a reference to the proverbial fax machine breaking down and you know, the mail room overflowing. But the fact is today with regulations.gov, things tend to come in, by and large, electronically. And that technological advancement actually brings with it an ease of kind of receipt, collation, you know, counting, reviewing, et cetera, of all the comments. And so I think even when you're dealing with what we call, you know, a mass comment campaign, I'm not of the opinion that it's such an inherent burden on the agency to accept and review those such that we're doing a disservice, if you will, or failing to adequately consider other more substantive comments that come in. And that's why, you know, I think our view is this is not, fortunately, a zero-sum game. So we don't need to look for ways of either diminishing, curtailing, or, you know, somehow cabining comments by making value judgments about them so that we can better receive and consider others. I think we are able to do both, you know, in today's world, and certainly my sense is things will get easier and easier as the technology improves. So the generic statement I think that I would make at the outset is I think the government has an obligation to accept all comments and not pass judgment on those that are coming in. And furthermore, we have the ability, really, to process these as they come in without diminishing the end product, really, which is the quality and the legal and technical basis of the rules that we do. I also mentioned that, you know, we think there's an inherent value, quite frankly, in engaging citizens in the process. There's an educational element to this. There is the notion that somebody, and again, I think, you know, I'll be referring now mostly to, again, what I've called these mass comment campaigns. And what I have in my mind, and I hope this is not unfair, is that you go onto the website of an organization that you might be a member of or subscribe to. They've identified a particular issue that's relevant to an EPA rulemaking. They may have any number of explanations about it. So, oddly enough, you don't need to go to reg.gov to figure out what a particular proposed rule means. You can get at least an organization's distilled view of what the proposal is like, and whether you agree with it or not, there might be some ways that you can quite easily submit those views, and it's either a submit here, maybe you add your own comments to it, or not. But there's something about that process, I think, that even separates that individual from somebody who is utterly disengaged. There are clearly, although we get millions of comments a year, what it really means is that there are hundreds of millions of people in this country, not all of age, if you will, that are not commenting on anything, that are not engaging with their government, they're not engaging with EPA. And so at the very least, we have folks who have taken the time and shown the interest on a number of our rules to explore what they mean, to read about them, whether directly through regs.gov or through a particular interest group, and to register a view. And so I think that there's something inherently valuable about just recognizing the step that those folks have taken, not only the educational process that they're undergoing to get that far, But by registering their views, I think they're engaging with their government and with the reg development process in a way that already separates them from 90% of their fellow citizens in this country. So then, you know, we turn to really what's the value of these sorts of mass comments. If they're not going to individually provide illumination on matters of science or technology or engineering, things that really speak to the heart of many of our statutory standards. And I guess there are a couple things that Marna and I tried to point out in our comment and our thinking on this. One is this kind of notion, and I think Professor Farina addresses this, of adding weight. It's kind of a group-framed preference. So you've got, you know, by way of example, Sierra Club expresses an opinion on something. And, you know, it's one thing if you've got one expression of that view. Certainly, it adds weight, if you will, if you've got 2 million expressions of that view. Now, you can argue about what does that weight really mean? What does it tell you? Well, we know at the very least it tells us that 2 million people have, again, engaged, registered some association with that view, with you know, whatever that submission was, and took the time to make that submission to the agency. So I think that has in and of itself a legitimate value that the agency ought to consider. The other thing it does is helps reveal a level of awareness out there. There's a great deal of effort done, I think, at EPA and across the federal government just to make sure people know what we're doing. It's really important, I think, that in all agencies like ours, that things not get slipped under the rug, that we do things in an open and transparent manner. And quite frankly, putting things on a website or putting things in reg.gov isn't in and of itself a measure of how extensive our outreach efforts have been. And we can look at certain rulemakings and say, well, we've gotten X number of comments, so clearly we've reached that sector or we've heard from that sector. But there are times when you get mass comment campaigns, and that is an indicator of the degree of outreach that you have, you know, the successful, I guess, outreach that you've undergone. And although I don't think it's an entire kind of accurate barometer of this, if ultimately what you're trying to do as well is make sure that you have looked at all pockets of society and all communities where there is substantive expertise, you know, people who live near a facility, who have observed things firsthand, people who have particular scientific expertise. One way of at least getting a sense of whether you've kind of reached into the right pockets of this country to get that is whether or not you also have, I think, broadly received some of these mass comments. Again, not a scientific comparison, but at least it's an indicator. And so I do think there's some value in there. And finally, I think the point that Marna and I wanted to emphasize with respect to these, again, mass comment campaigns was just bringing a voice to the undervoiced or the underserved. It's my assessment that if you look at a lot of the comments that the agency receives, not only has they're undergone a lot of time and effort in submitting them, but it's clear that along with that time and effort has been a great deal of expense. And again, it's very important that EPA in particular get the best information from the people best able to marshal it. Oftentimes those may be lawyers, they may be engineers, people in industry and elsewhere, but not everybody can afford either the cost of doing that, not everybody can afford the time that it takes. And so I do think that, again, getting folks engaged with EPA and the system, getting them educated, and expanding the number of people who aren't burdened by the expense of these weighty comments is really valuable in and of itself. So the more people, and certainly the more what I would call the undervoiced or the people who we don't typically reach, that make that effort to reach back to us and register a view, I think we're doing a benefit certainly in the reg development process. So with that, I guess, you know, I'll sum up, but if I thought this was not a zero-sum game, and that we were really harming our ability to put out the best and kind of best justified rules, I might have either taken a different position or kind of couched my remarks a little bit differently. But I really don't think that we're at that place given the technology that we have. We have the ability to accept it all, and I think there's really value in doing so.
Thank you for those thoughtful comments. Michael Halpern, you want to go next?
Yes, and I have PowerPoint, if that. I don't know. There's a clicker.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is there a clicker somewhere?
Oh.
I got it.
Thank you.
The red light.
I want you
the
to be
beautiful
heard.
Red light.
I want you to be heard.
Thank
and
you.
Participate in the process, Mike.
Oh, that's so great.
So thanks again to Eli and Vanderbilt for putting this together and to Senator Udall for making the space available. I am not a lawyer. I think a 70-page article is really kind of a small book. So I'll leave it to you guys to sort of figure out how we operationalize this. But this is a great conversation to be having right now because so much cool and innovative and experimental stuff is going on, trying to figure out how to curate information as well as increase sort of public engagement. The internet has allowed us to weigh in so many more ways. It's not a new problem. I know that 10 or 15 years ago we were agonizing over whether or not we should allow electronic comments to be filed. Before that it was whether or not we should allow people to fax in comments. And so the technology doesn't matter as much as making sure that we curate things well. And the authors of this paper, I think, have developed regulation room to do just that for rule writers. But I think there's more than just a discussion about whether or not this should be the tool that's used. It's sort of a yes and question. And there's a greater question I have is how do we build participatory democracy by enriching mass engagement that leads to rules that are both legitimate and of high quality. Legitimacy is thing is really important, which means that there's public buy-in to the rule. On the issue of mass comments, it's important to point out that not all mass comments are equal. Some are unique and some are form letters. Some share expertise and some share ideology. And as you know, the EPA pointed out in its draft paper, there is value in all of these different perspectives. Mass comment campaigns can elicit comments that share all four attributes coming from the same organization. Members of the Union of Concerned Scientists Science Network, which consists of about 17,000 experts from all kinds of different backgrounds, often engage in mass comment campaigns that we engineer. But rather than giving them a standard sort of form letter to fill out and send, we provide primary source material, we give them talking points, we give them our analysis, and we allow them to form their own conclusions. While some of these busy experts do simply cut and paste talking points, others use the resources and their own expertise to develop more detailed and thoughtful and informed comments. In her presentation, the author talked about how a democratic government should not actively facilitate public input it does not value. Well, my question is, what is value? There are many indirect benefits that are as important or more important than providing expert advice to the rule writer. The public comment period gives an organization like ours a concrete, finite opportunity to bring a proposed rule to the attention of our constituents and explain its import to them. Often, this is the only time that the public has to weigh in on regulation. Second, running a mass comment campaign enables organizations to identify those individuals who do want to engage more substantively and can provide more specialized expertise now or in the future. An expert who is willing to file a public comment might be more willing to meet with a legislator or a reporter or to attend a public hearing or to otherwise engage. More input, of course, does not guarantee better decisions, but more varied public participation in rulemaking can bring perspectives from people with diverse knowledge and skills, which the authors refer to as situated knowledge, not only to the regulatory agency, but to all of the other people who read the public comments, whether that be reporters or public interest groups or industry organizations or whoever it might be. this situated knowledge can and should be present not only during the public comment period, but throughout the rulemaking process. And there are different people within and outside of government who are trying to figure out how to make that a reality. The idea that rulemaking is rational and above politics, though, is just simply not true. We know that it is quite often that highly contentious rulemakings need public attention, so there's less inappropriate influence on the process. We all know the EPA is under pretty relentless attack from the entities regulated by the agency, by certain members of Congress, and even by the White House as it attempts to fulfill its statutory responsibility. Congress has attempted a number of times to curb the EPA's regulatory authority, and the White House officials under both the Obama and Bush administrations, the past two and more, have interfered in the rulemaking process for political reasons. Mass comments can signal both to the rule writer and to the political appointees that their conduct will be scrutinized, the rules are valued, and that this sort of signal can play a moderating role in terms of their conduct. In other words, mass comments can make rulemaking more resilient to ideological pressure. Take ground-level ozone pollution. The Bush White House effectively just put the squeeze on former Administrator Stephen Johnson to set smog standards that were weaker than those suggested by staff scientists and the agency's Clean Air Science Advisory Committee, despite the fact that the Clean Air Act requires these standards to be set solely on the best available scientific information. The Obama administration pledged to reverse this. Then, when push came to shove, the administration ordered former Administrator Lisa Jackson to withdraw a proposal that was supported by the science. But public attention helped get that pound of flesh from each administration for this sort of interference. We need to make sure that when we do talk about public participation, we don't create further delays in developing science-based rules. OSHA has been trying to update its standard for exposure to toxic silica dust for 14 years. A lot of the time, those opposed to a new rule claim that we don't know enough about a given topic to develop a credible rule, and that further, you know, often redundant studies are necessary to kick the can down the road. Organizations cling to mass comments in the current situation because it's where the process is more transparent. The public comment period is very different from closed-door meetings that happen that erode faith in government and, in turn, undermine a rule's effectiveness. A transparent process is substantially more likely to lead to rules that are considered to be of high quality and legitimate, which I give equal importance. You know, a rule that's being considered to be illegitimate will be equally ineffective. Back to the silica rule. OSHA is using a novel approach to transparency during a current rulemaking, this current rulemaking. The agency is asking, not requesting, but asking commenters to disclose their own financial conflicts of interest as well as conflicts of interest related to research that they cite. Although some senators and industry representatives have objected to this request, the practice has become the norm within reputable scientific journals and should become the norm across government. The public comment period also allows the public to understand and analyze arguments made by affected industries and compare their comments to previous public positions. A recent analysis that we did found that there can be inconsistencies. We looked at ConocoPhillips, which acknowledges on its website that, quote, human activity is contributing to increased concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But in its comments on the 2009 endangerment finding, the company claimed that, quote, the support for the effect of climate change on public health and welfare is limited and is typified by a high degree of uncertainty. Those are two very different statements. So how can we do better? Improving public input to rulemaking requires significant change among a variety of different cultures. Those who employ and guide experts, universities, companies, scientific societies, and even governments, should incentivize and reward public participation. In science, career advancement is generally not based on public engagement, but on peer-reviewed papers, and this should be diversified. The way in which nonprofits and industry groups use the Internet must also improve. And current technologies and content management systems are disastrously behind the curve and limit the sorts of varied input that we can put forward. Bloggers and reporters also have unrealized responsibilities to report on the organizations behind mass comments, to disclose conflicts of interest, and to link to resources that allow readers to file their own comments and engage in the process. And finally, advocacy organizations should become more effective at fully utilizing the people that do support them. Too many are focused on vanity metrics or measures that look good on paper but might not actually measure impact and fail to measure success in more sophisticated ways. But there's a ton more to be done here in terms of experimentation and collaboration. We must reinvent the process of decision making. I do think the Regulation Room authors are engaging in one interesting experiment, but there should be many others, and there are many others that are happening. We need to think in terms of new systems of how we collaborate throughout the rulemaking process. Clay Shirky, who is an internet scholar at New York University, talks about our untapped cognitive surplus. He says, our cognitive surplus is so enormous that diverting even a tiny fraction of time from consumption to participation can create enormous positive effects. Those who accept the current model of mass comments or public comments as being the only or even main way to engage a large number of people in governance are simply not being sufficiently creative. Nico Mele of the Harvard Kennedy School looks at how government can be disrupted in a good way by technology and the people who wield it. We have to build an infrastructure of participation, he says. We have to build process and politics that understand the new distribution of power. Hundreds of startups and thousands of hackers are working on open source programming to develop this infrastructure. The government can facilitate this process by going beyond transparency and reexamining how it allocates IT resources to improve input. The Affordable Care Act rollout was a disaster precisely because resources went to those who know how to play the system, not those who know how to build a system. There's Capitol Bells, PopVox, Public Labs, the Sunlight Foundation, and many others who want to build collaborative systems with government, and they need government to realizing their goals of bringing more meaningful participation and to democratic processes. And there is innovation that's also happening within government and with private public partnerships as well in terms of experimentation. So, you know, I think that with more varied, robust methods of public input and collaboration, we can reduce dependence on mass public comments and reinvigorate the role that citizen experts can play to make policy that really protects health and safety while also encouraging innovation and economic growth. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Michael, for those great remarks. I love some of those slides. They're terrific. Mike, you want to next?
Well, thanks very much. I particularly want to thank ELI and Vanderbilt for the opportunity to be here today. I really find that the LPAR process is really valuable in helping make the academic work in environmental law and regulatory issues much more accessible to practitioners and policymakers. So I'd like to step back a bit and just comment briefly on what are we trying to do in regulation, and how does sort of this notion that we're going to enhance public participation fit in? I think that the purpose of regulation is to govern effectively. It's also to govern efficiently. To me, that means that a regulation should be drawn as narrowly as possible in order to achieve the policy objective. It should be cost-effective, and hopefully it returns net benefits to society. Those aren't new concepts, right? Those have been around at least since President Clinton issued Executive Order 12866. President Obama sort of reissued it as Executive Order 13563. And for me, the purpose of sort of unlocking the regulatory process to participation, to identify those sort of missing participants or that missing information, is a key objective of ours here. And I think Cynthia's article really goes to the heart of how can you really structure those approaches. Now, the one thing I think that hasn't been really focused on so far is that what the regulatory process doesn't do. So we had a very nice presentation from Jed Purdy earlier, and he spoke of the language of cost-benefit in Michael's written comment. that he didn't mention here. He made an excellent comment that the regulatory process is designed to value evidence and devalue preferences. And, you know, that's appropriate, I think, because we've established the value in the statutory law. We've established and we've interpreted those values in litigation. But regulation is really about implementing those values. The sort of the focus on the narrowest possible scope, cost effectiveness, and benefits certainly doesn't eliminate the need to account for preferences, but those generalized citizens' preferences themselves shouldn't govern our effort to get to good results in the regulatory process. And I think that's a notion that Cynthia's brought out in her article very well. I certainly agree that we shouldn't be looking at excluding anyone from the process. As Avi said, participation has an intrinsic civic value, probably civil value as well, and that all inputs are valued, but just not the same. So if I turn to the specifics of sort of rulemaking 2.0 and its role, I think Cynthia's has really done a nice job in identifying how it supplements some of the Web 2.0, rulemaking 1.0 efforts. And as a supplement, I think it's a very helpful adjunct to tools that already exist. And what I have in mind here is a tool that regulatory agencies already have to enhance public participation in the rulemaking process up front, and that's the advance notice of proposed rulemaking. It's, I think, little used these days because of the pressures that are on agencies to produce rulemaking. It does suggest an inherently longer rulemaking process because you go out, you start to ask the right questions, identify who needs to be engaged in a particular rulemaking, what sort of specialized knowledge do we need to bring forward. But it is a way, it's a mechanism for an agency to upfront start asking the questions that engage not only the experts, but encourage broader participation and hopefully to get to better policy results. And I think it actually makes a lot of sense. And to my knowledge, I'm not aware of any research that's been done in this, but I suspect that a rule that's been through the AMPRM process probably holds up better in the in litigation or reproposals, relitigation, et cetera, than those are not. I think I'd like to close this short comment with just a focus on what happens if this process is successful? And what happens if suddenly that participation that we believe is missing or that knowledge that hasn't been unlocked suddenly is delivered to the agencies? I think EPA does a wonderful job in getting through the comments that it gets. And it gets a lot of comments, hopefully most of it meaningful, especially from organizations like mine. But I think we haven't done a lot of work right now on developing the technology we need to improve the assessment and integration of those comments into the policy, into the regulatory output. I think agencies are criticized, and a lot of times appropriately so, for failing to do a good job on accounting for the input they receive. How did that particular piece of input influence the outcome? And to me, we expect our agencies to value input. We expect them to make those judgments and to actually pass judgment on the comment they receive, right? And yet, most of the time, at the end of the process, we don't see that coming forward. The final comment I'd make is the technology itself is challenging agencies. We're finding more and more opportunities for situated knowledge to be very personal and to potentially influence a regulatory process. I noted in my brief written comment the emergence of smartphone-enabled sensing technologies. Somebody has recently done in the scientific community has noted that the rubber bracelets, you know, Live Strong and other things like that, are excellent receptors for environmental pollutants and could start to, you know, gauge, could be part of the input that an agency is asked to consider. And how you deal with that type of stuff, I think, is something that we yet have to grapple with in the future. So, Cynthia, thanks very much for a very interesting article and a thought-provoking piece of work.
Well, thank you for those wonderful comments. Cynthia, would you like to take some time and respond to what you've heard?
Sure. Thank you. Whoops. Let's see. Yes? Yes. Good. Okay. So I think there's a lot of common ground here, unsurprisingly. We are all committed to the notion that broader participation in the rulemaking process, given its extraordinary importance as setting public policy in our country, is extremely important. And, of course, there's no question of somehow or other banning advocacy organizations from doing mass comment campaigns. That would be illegal, as well as Bobby points out, as well as undoubtedly unwise as a policy matter. And mass comment campaigns are with us for a long time because, as Mike Halperin explained, there are a lot of organizational reasons for advocacy organizations to do them. The question I think we were really trying to focus on is, what do you do when you're met with the kind of email that we got from one of our users saying, yeah, I get that you took all the information in this rulemaking and you broke it down and you explained it in plain language and I kind of see that and, you've given me the opportunity to sort of engage with other people, but that is so much work. And what you should do is just give me a way to vote on this. Just let me express my preferences. What do we do as participation designers? What do agencies do as they are faced with questions, right, about using these various new technologies, more of which, as Mike says, are emerging every day? And, as I listened to Avi, as I read their paper and listened to Avi, EPA is in a really tough situation on this because, as he says, we're all directly affected by many of the rulemakings, particularly the high-profile rulemakings that are going on. And very few of us have, and it's not just technical or scientific knowledge, but it's kind of the lived experience knowledge that's going to help EPA know, where to set carbon emission levels or whatever. And so this idea that we can use with other agencies of, missing stakeholders and situated knowledge may not help EPA so much in a lot of these particularly high-profile rulemakings. And nobody thinks that, well, even I, as a law professor, let me put it this way, don't think that rulemaking is simply about reasoned decision-making. It would be crazy to assert that when EPA gets, 3 million comments on carbon emissions that they shouldn't pay attention to that or that nobody does pay attention to that. Of course people are paying attention to that. The agents, certainly the White House is paying attention to that. It's being paid attention to on the Hill. And particularly the agency's political leadership has to pay attention to that, just like they do to any other significant event in the political environment. It's also, of course, the case that even in these rulemakings that are highly technical, we don't believe that these rulemakings are all about science and not about preferences and value choices and priority setting, right? So EPA's in a hard situation because they need to balance those things, the politics and the reasoning, the science and the values, in a setting where, to pick up on a couple of other themes, the line between bending science and taking appropriate, account of democratic value preferences can be very gray and might depend on whether you agree with the politics of the particular administration. Just like it's often very difficult to tell, when should regulatory policy follow public preferences and when should it lead public preferences and values? I think the thing that we were trying to struggle with in looking at the mass comment situation was the following question. All right. Values are relevant. people's preferences, people's priorities are relevant. But how should the agency get good information about that? Oh, hard to figure out how relevant, hard, but how should it get good information about it? And when we look at the mass commenting phenomenon, actually, not even me, when other researchers look at it, here's what they see. Well, first of all, of course, you can't possibly say that mass comments generated by advocacy groups give a reliable insight into what the American public think, because they're not representative samples, right? So we can start there, right? But doesn't it mean something when 3 million people say something, right, on carbon emissions? Well, actually, it turns out 3 million comments is not 3 million people. And here's a real transparency problem. It's, of course, quite reasonable to assume that, but studies of those kinds of comments, Stuart Shulman at UMass Amherst is really the expert here. He studied multiple of these, including EPA's mercury rulemaking and a couple of endangered species rulemakings, discovered that a very large percentage of those comments were duplicate. In other words, were sent by a single person who sent like 200 to over 300. Over half in a couple of those rulemakings, including the mercury rulemaking. So it's not 3 million, but maybe it's 1 million, right? That's sort of a fair. Well, shouldn't we take account of those? But then we have to ask, how were those preferences formed? And what was the information that was available to those people? I totally agree, Mike.
I just want to interrupt for 1 minute because I know that Avi has to get on a plane.
Ah.
And so I want to make sure he just gets a chance if he would like to respond. And we really appreciate your being here, Avi, and I do know you have a car waiting. So and then we'll come back.
Okay.
I appreciate it. I guess the only thing I would say, and this may be certainly my parting words, is that you don't know what you don't know, right? We get these comments in all the time, and whether they're cookie-cutter comments, it's almost impossible to know the degree of situated knowledge, for example, that may be behind them. And so if two people were to submit, you know, in a mass campaign the same comment, it's impossible, really, based on that, to know whether one of those individuals says, I agree because I, you know, in my own experience, I have observed the conditions that form the basis of this comment, versus someone who says, you know, I just hit this button every time I go on this website. And my concern is that, you know, as soon as we start to try to line draw a little bit, invariably what we may do is draw the wrong line. And whereas it's great to try to exclude the, you know, to separate the wheat from the chaff, at the end of the day, you will probably sweep under the rug some important knowledge that people have sought to submit, and we have denigrated it only because of its commonality with, you know, its neighboring comments. So, those were some of the thoughts about, again, to the extent we can technologically receive all of these things, I think it's, frankly, the safer bet. And the safer way to go from a good government standpoint, not to separate. But thank you very much.
We really appreciate your coming. Yeah. Do you have time to take one question, maybe?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. And then I'm sorry to do this in a somewhat haphazard fashion,
but
we're trying
thanks.
To accommodate various schedules. Do we have a mic in the audience if anyone has a question? And it would be wonderful. It could be a question, not a long comment with a question, just given our time constraints. Any questions for Avi? Yeah, that would be great if you could speak.
So between Ms. Farina and Avi, it seems like you come to different conclusions about having more participation. So on the one hand, there's the idea that having these mass participation, there's kind of a charade, and those comments are not really valued in the final decision, whereas your position is that it increases buy-in and it helps people feel like they're contributing to government. So what's drawing that line between the two perspectives?
I guess my point of view is that I don't know what was in the mind of the commenter. And so it may be that some people in submitting a comment think that it says things that we as the agency receiving it don't think it says. It may be that they have pronounced views about how it's going to be received and the importance and all. Or maybe their views are totally different from the reality, which is somebody's going to say that was one of 250,000 and that's the end of it. But we will never be able on a comment by comment basis to reliably insert ourselves, if you will, into the mind of the commenter. And so while nobody wants to be deceptive in any way, again, my overarching concern is that if we start making value judgments because we don't want to do this or don't want to do that, we may end up excluding people who under the law and as part of our democracy really have valuable things to say.
Any other quick questions? And we'll let Avi go, and we'll just sort of resume. We had originally thought we might try to combine the Q&A for these last two panels because of the overlap in topic, but I think given that we have people that are coming and going, it might be better to just go ahead and wrap up here with some questions for the panel and for Professor Farina. Michael or Mike, do either... Avi, thank you again. We know you're very busy. Michael or Mike, do you have any observations you want to offer before we turn to Q&A?
No. Can I just answer the other half of that question?
Sure.
Which is, I think, again, I think there's no disagreement about the importance of trying to extend people's sense that they are participating in these processes. My focus is always, new technology can accomplish such amazing things if we're really trying to be thoughtful and creative. And so, what you've mentioned, actually Avi mentioned, is a very well-recognized psychological phenomenon that if you take a small step, if someone takes a small step, they're more likely to take another step and another step and another step. So that, in fact, you can design, right, a system that uses that instinct we have, right, to vote, to rank, to, sort of, and use it as a channel, right, not as the end, but is the beginning. So you can say to people, what matters most to you? Bop, 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 bop. And when you get a vote, say to them, would you like to learn more about that? And go to, right, the place where there's an explanation of that issue, and then they can engage more with it. And I think that's really where, it's sort of, I would say, I don't think we're actually so far apart. I think my focus is just a different one of thinking that we can do so much more with technology to build a more robust kind of participation out in the public. And I hope we don't, sort of just cheap out.
Other questions for the panelists? Ira?
Hi. I guess I'm a little surprised that that none of the panelists mentioned anything about EPA's history with regulatory negotiation, or the advent of more structured multi-stakeholder processes that have been experimented with, certainly in the voluntary standards arena. And I wanted to ask Cynthia, first of all, whether her article focuses just on notice and comment rulemaking, or you get into some of the other options, given that notice and comment rulemaking is clearly somewhat flawed and has limitations, and shouldn't we all, for the other panelists, shouldn't we be looking at other options?
We have this particular article focuses on notice and comment rulemaking. It was because of the particular platform that we were working with, but a shout out to EPA, who has been phenomenally innovative in the kinds of processes they use and in general in their use of technology. And I think one of the things that, you'd like to see participation design think about is what are other ways to get, say, more representative sense of what people's preferences are. There's a lot of different, mechanisms that have been designed and have been proven by experimentation in the field, right? Not just students and real people, real citizens, real issues, that are available to agencies to use. And to the extent that we can develop technology that makes those easier, great. Great thing. And so I think, you know, all credit to EPA. I agree with you completely. They have been extremely innovative.
Michael or Mike, do you want to add anything?
I think the tools that Cynthia's discussed could also help leverage participation in a negotiated rulemaking. I'm not sure how many of those we're actually going to see now. I think, you know, some of those, there's some inherent problems in that process as well, particularly in identifying upfront who's going to participate in that negotiation. But I think the tool could be leveraged there.
Yeah, there's a lot of work that has to be done, and is really just starting to be done from what I'm aware of, on how to best integrate in-the-room processes with online processes. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we know that it's much more effective for people to collaboratively draft online if they've met each other once.
That's interesting.
Right? And so how could we use that insight, right? If you think about public meetings in involved communities, right, and using community organizations to reach out to people and start to engage them on these issues, and then you move to some online participation so that people that can't come to public meetings, right, single parents who can't afford babysitters, or, you know, recent immigrants who aren't real comfortable with the language and standing up in public, so that they can also be involved in situations where, you know, they can participate on their own time, whatever, using public libraries as a way to overcome the digital divide. Lots of really exciting things happening now. You know, as people think about how can we meld technology and traditional processes to get more engagement.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I would advocate an all of the above strategy when it comes to input, but most of the above strategy. You know, looking at different ways of getting input, of bringing people in, and you know, I mean, there are colleges and universities out there who are doing hackathons, bringing in their computer scientist coder kids to figure out new ways to interface with mm-hmm. government at all levels. So just as long as all of these different experiments are happening in a transparent way so that legitimacy is built, and I think we're in a good space. And it completely varies by agency. You know, OSHA deleted its Twitter account because it couldn't handle it or something. So different agencies are more comfortable with experimentation, and it doesn't necessarily depend on how regulatory the agency is. You know, we find that there's less political interference in the scientific work of agencies that have less regulatory authority. But when it comes to experimentation with public comment, it's kind of all across the board.
Yeah. And to pick up a theme from the earlier comment, you know, trying to focus at the community level, the local level, not so much at the national level, or at least, you know, at the community and local level. Initially, there's all sorts of interesting stuff going on in municipalities who are much more nimble in many instances about using technology and using it to get participation from citizens at ground level. And some of these important issues, particularly environmental issues, you know, support can be built at that level. And literacy about participation policy process can be built at that level.
We have federal, you know, online folks who come to me and say, I wish I could do Vine videos. I wish I could do these other things. I can't because the government won't let me because they haven't determined that it is secure enough.
Right.
And so those challenges, those need to be either facilitated a little bit quicker or eliminated because local governments are doing it better.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but this has been a really, I think, important and interesting discussion, and thank you very much for joining us.